We'd like to welcome another episode of Africa on the Move. Tonight we will claim no easy victories, nor are we telling lies. Tonight we're going to speak truth to power. And on that particular theme, speaking truth to power, we're going to have two guests tonight. We have Brother Hakeem from the African Welding Association and Cheryl LaBosh from the Labor Exchange. They're going to be giving their views and perspectives on various issues and giving us a current update on some of the current affairs that have an impact on us here and globally. Right now, I would like to introduce Brother Hakeem from the African Welding Association, ask him to tell a little something about African Welding Association and just briefly a little something about him, about himself. Brother Hakeem.
Yes. My name is Hakeem Mashoki, and I'm with the African Awareness. And essentially what we do is we're geared toward enlightening the community. Things like symposiums, education workshops, you know, programs of community. We're geared toward uplifting of our people in the sense that we want to educate people about the importance of humanity. And we feel that in doing so, one of the things that's very, very important that we do is that we dispel a lot of misconceptions, a lot of the disinformation or outright lies that permeate society. So in doing so, we understand that not only do we lift people intellectually, but we also get people to begin to question the nature of the beast, in hopes that somehow that they will energize people to actually stand up and fight for those things which are humane. In trying to achieve this paradigm shift, we realize it's a protracted struggle, and we're not expecting any easy victories, but we realize this process has to start somewhere. So that's essentially what we do.
Okay, our next guest we have with us is Sister Cheryl LaBosh from the Labor Exchange. She's going to introduce herself and also tell us a little something about Labor Exchange. Sister Cheryl?
Hi, thank you, Lee, and thank you for having this really important radio show now, because it's so important to speak truth to power and have our own media, people's media. The U.S.-Cuba Labor Exchange has worked since 1991 to build ties between working people in the United States and the people of socialist Cuba, particularly through the labor movement. Right now, I'm actually in Washington, D.C., helping to build a series of programs and concerts in solidarity with the Cuban Five. It's the 14th anniversary of their arrest in Miami and their unjust trial and conviction, and we're fighting to free them. So we just had a wonderful concert on Wednesday of two musicians who came from Cuba just for this. And we had a standing room only concert at the Bolivarian Hall at the Venezuelan Embassy in Washington, D.C. And tonight we had a terrific program with Rafael Cancel Miranda, who is a freedom fighter from Puerto Rico who served 25 years in U.S. prisons and was released because of the international outcry and solidarity. It shows that we can win.
Okay, good. As you see, our theme tonight is speaking truth to power. One of the first questions I would just like to ask both of y'all, in reference to the year 2012, what is it like being a political organizer? I know y'all been organizing for years. Just give people a general idea, what are some of the issues, problems, and just overall nature of what's it like to be a political organizer today? I start with you, Brother Hakeem.
Yeah, I think in many respects, in terms of organizing people, it's probably more problematic. There's a lot more distraction than exists currently, and the level of propaganda, outright lies that are disseminated throughout the media, is much more concentrated. It's much more organized. So the one of the strange things is that, you know, when you look at the major media outlets, they essentially repeat the same stories over and over again. So needless to say that the communities are getting a daily dose of BS, you know, 24 hours a day. So at some level it makes it organized a bit more problematic. And I also got to give props to those who were in control of the power structure in terms of their ability to not only manipulate people in the U.S., but on a global scale. I think the election, and I may get in trouble with this, but the election of Barack Obama is a clear indication in terms of just how strategically these people move in terms of their ability to manipulate thought or mood. There are those who perceive Barack Obama as a savior, you know, to humankind. But in fact, if you look at Barack Obama's policies, it's very, very clear that this man is far from the center. It's far from progressive. In fact, he is to the right of the center. So, but having said that, I think that there's so many distractions in terms of organizing people, but those are the challenges in which we're compelled to face. And so that's just, I think, the nature of the beast.
Sister Cheryl?
Well, I have to agree that there are some particular difficulties and a lot of distractions, and that's why programs like this one are so important, because we need a people's media to get the truth out. Personally, in my recent experience, I live in Detroit. There seems to be the beginning of openness because of the crisis that people are facing. You know, people are starting to look at it in terms, at least it seems to me, a little bit more in terms of the overall system, focusing on the role of the banks. You know, that it's not just a politician. There's a problem with the kind of system for profit that we live under. So it's challenging in a lot of ways because people are distracted not only by the media and by sports and, you know, by trying to anesthetize themselves from the pain that they're suffering every day, but there's also the distraction of just trying to live when you can't find work, when you're threatened with losing your house, with, so there are a lot of distractions, but I think that it also has opened the door for people to look at a more at the system, the capitalist system as a whole, as the source of their problems.
Okay, Sister Cheryl, you mentioned something just now in your last remarks about the importance of trying to find work or create work for the everyday people. I would like for both of y'all to respond to this question of how can jobs be created inside the U.S. as it relates to this whole concept of globalization? In other words, what impact the globalization has on this whole possibility of creating jobs inside the border of the U.S.? And I'm saying that in reference to understanding the nature of capitalism, as they seem to be based upon making a profit, a commodity to make a profit. If the incentives are not there to make profit, you know, those who have capital, they will go elsewhere. So I'm wondering, in terms of as an organizer, when we keep talking about creating jobs inside the United States of America, but at the same time saying the path we should choose is looking at this issue of going globalized, there seems to be a dichotomy or contradiction between the two in terms of the nature of the two. If you know that capital goes wherever they can make some more profit, then if that's the reality is, do y'all really see any bright future for the working class here in America in terms of the question of job growth and development?
Well, let me just jump in in respect to that question. I think one of the first things that we have to understand, when we talk about this concept of full employment, people should not be deceived in terms of what that concept really means. Full employment does not mean full employment in the sense that everybody should have a right to a job. The last time back in the late 60s when the Humphrey Hawkins bill, in which they actually tried to push this amendment for full employment, which in other words, everyone in America must have a job, that Congress shot it down. And the reason they shot it down, because under the capitalist system, there's no way you can have full employment in a legitimate sense, in the sense that everybody can have a job. If everyone has a job, in the minds of the capitalists, then what you're doing is cutting into the profit margin. And that's what capitalism is about. It's all about the bottom line. That's the first thing. With respect to globalism, I think one of the things you have to understand is that prior to globalism, you had monopoly finance capitalism. In other words, what happened was there was a shrinking labor force in terms of people actually have the opportunity to receive jobs. All right. And at the same time, during the late 80s, at the same point, which you start seeing massive numbers of corporations relocating throughout the world. And so, therefore, obviously, the focus is not in terms of employing people in America, but the focus is on profit for the few, for those capitalists who actually control the means of production. So this notion that somehow that Barack Obama, anybody else for that matter, is going to somehow create a system in which it's going to employ the people, it's just disinformation. It's disingenuous. It's not true. It's not real. And it's important that we understand this whole concept in terms of, you know, when people talk about this thing in terms of full employment, what that really means. Full employment is constantly changes from decade to decade according to the needs of the capitalist class. And as it stands now, they're situated in such a perfect position in terms of, you know, eradicating, you know, work and getting rid of the labor force that it's nothing short. I mean, a real strong movement is going to even bring even the semblance of being able to put people in positions of work. So, in answer to your question, Brother Lee, it's like in terms of employment for masses of people in this country, it's simply not going to happen under the current.
Sister Cheryl, you mentioned this question of banks, talking about the role of banks as relates to the lives of the people in Detroit and as well as throughout this country. What role has the banks played in terms of having an impact on the people's lives in Detroit, and how are the people dealing with the banks in Detroit?
Well, the the question of jobs and the question of the banks are interrelated, mm-hmm. And what the brother said about the fact that under capitalism there is no such thing as full employment, it's based on the bottom line, is very true, and he gave a very thorough explanation of how that works. There's an additional factor that in this current era, and he touched on that as well, that is the role of technology, and that technology has helped create more products, overproduction, than people can possibly consume. They can't be sold at a profit. They're not producing for people's needs. And that's really what's at the heart of this current economic crisis and why the capitalist system itself can't create even the false full employment that it's had in the past, where, you know, 3 or 4% or 5 or 6% was considered full employment. It just can't do it anymore, because under a capitalist system they have to sell what they produce at a profit, and they can't do it anymore. So they wind up. And we see that in housing, in particular in Detroit. And we also see it in the kind of cutbacks in government programs and government jobs in the post office and in a whole variety of other areas that, when capitalist economy is going strong, well, you don't really notice the interest on the bonds that have to be paid to the banks. You don't really notice any of that because it just comes out of the tax money. But when there's an economic crisis, the banks still want their pound of flesh, no matter how much suffering they have created through speculation and the housing bubble. In Detroit, first of all, even before the housing crisis, there was a bigger crisis. The auto companies that created a huge migration of people to come into Detroit at the auto plants. The auto plants shut down, and they automated, and they moved out of the central city. You know, people talk about offshoring, but really it wasn't only offshoring, because it was high automation that also replaced you know, the jobs that people had with machines, and then moved them out of the city. So there are whole tracts of land based on that era that have been bulldozed and are just vacant. And then came the economic crisis in 2008 that was created by speculation, and, you know, instead of getting capitalist profit from the general, you know, production, what the system did is said, well, listen, we can't make the money in normal production anymore. So what we're going to do is make money out of speculation. And housing in particular, it's what they call a multiplier, where you build a house and somebody moves into it, so you have to have all the building materials, and then there's all of the furnishings and appliances and all of these things. But so they, you know, they built all this McMansions and housing housing subdivisions, you know, based on this bubble of speculation that was going on. And then what they did is, you know, you and I, if we loan money to a friend, you know, they pay us back, and it's a person-to-person kind of thing. But what was going on was they would a mortgage would be written, the broker would get you know, fees and all that, and then they would resell it. So the person who initiated that mortgage had no interest in whether that mortgage would ever be paid back. So especially in Detroit, they came in and sold subprime loans. There was just like the racist redlining over the years, when the mortgage market, you take a suburban white area and a Detroit area that was mostly people of African descent, and you found that in the white areas there was they were like regular market rate loans, but in Detroit they were subprime loans. So people were paying higher interest, and then they weren't real loans. They weren't genuine loans. They were loans that were made just to, and were sold and encouraged and pushed on people to make money for the brokers who were collecting the fees and who were repackaging the loans. So, you know, now, I mean, really, you just, if you haven't been to Detroit lately, come on to Detroit and see what the banks have done. And people are fighting back. We fought, and we're still fighting for a moratorium on foreclosures and evictions. We've called on President Obama to sign an executive order. We don't believe that there's any president that does anything but represent the capitalist system and the government. You know, capitalist government that is what this country is run by. But you still have to make the demands on whoever it is and organize the people to do it. So people are resisting. They're protecting their homes. They're fighting the banks. They're massing when there are threats of eviction. But there's more that has to be done. It's only just beginning. I hope that addresses the question you asked, Lee.
Okay, that's fine. What we're going to do right now, before we open up our lines to our callers, we're going to take a 30-second break. We're going to pause for the calls, and then we'll be right back with our guest, Brother Haki and Sister Cheryl. We had just paused for a call. So we're coming back on Africa on the Move with our theme tonight, Speaking Truth to Power. Tonight we have Brother Haki from the African Land Association and Sister Cheryl Labach from the U.S. Cuba Labor Exchange. Right now, for our callers, if you're interested in participating in this conversation tonight, you are welcome to call in at 323-679-0841. That's 323-679-0841. Let's continue this discussion, Speaking Truth to Power. Brother Haki, there's a debate among the two so-called political parties in the United States, the Democrat and Republican Party, over the concept of the role of privatization as it relates to trying to come out of this depression that the people are in right now. How do you conceive, what is your philosophical understanding of the role of privatization as it relates to an economic stimulus to change the suffering of people right now?
No, I don't think anybody should be deceived with the notion in terms of privatization. Privatization never have and never will contribute to the problems that the humanity is confronted with. If you go all the way back to Reagan in terms of privatization, one of the things was to mention was that if you privatize, if you give these businesses, you know, or functions of government to private individuals, that somehow they would somehow make a success of it, and in the process hire lots and lots of people. But of course, that's been demonstrated to be a falsehood for a long, long time. So the issue of privatization is a smokescreen. I think at this point, most people, at least a lot of people, are beginning to realize that it's just a smokescreen. Privatization, and all privatization does is concentrate the wealth. That's all it does. It doesn't disseminate the wealth. It concentrates the wealth. And in the process of concentrating the wealth, then it exacerbates inequities, be they economic or social, or it facilitates injustice. That's all privatization does. It does nothing in terms of solving the ills that human beings are confronted with. Now, one of the things that if you look at the wars in terms of the privatization of wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, in terms of formerly it was called the Blackwater, the U.S. government privatized functions that are normally reserved for the military to do. In the process, they end up spending $18 billion per year just on this particular corporation, Blackwater. $18 billion a year. Okay, money obviously that could be used in terms of stimulating the economy, getting people to work, and those kind of things that are useful to humanity. But the whole notion that privatization somehow made the war much more easy to conduct was a misnomer, because it didn't. In fact, exacerbated this so-called war over a conflict, because what happened is that these guys did things, and because they weren't part of the U.S. Governmental structure, they were able to do things that were illegal, things that were criminal, and get away with it. And in the final analysis, it backfired, because then it gave the U.S. a black eye, because everyone began to see U.S. in different light in terms of its imperialist policies. And so, therefore, this notion of privatization never will and never can be an answer to the needs of humanity.
Okay. Sister Cheryl, I noticed that right now I think we have a caller. Let's take this caller right now. Caller?
Hi.
Welcome
I'm listening.
Welcome to After the Move. Your question or comment, please.
None. I was just listening.
You just listening? Okay, no problem. We were going to give you opportunity. If you wanted to say something, you're welcome. No problem.
Okay, thank you.
Sister Cheryl, it is very important to us on Africa on the Move, anytime we have a chance to speak to the masses, to talk about a case that is very important to the world as we talk about this global fight against terrorism. You know, the U.S. government has taken a position that they are the number one component against terrorism. Yet they have an international case that everybody knows that there are five heroes out of Cuba that came to U.S. to fight terrorism, and when they decided to share information with the U.S. government about stopping terrorism, they were incarcerated. Can you take some time, if you can, at least in 2-3 minutes first, just discuss a little bit of history about who is the Cuban Five and how does it relate to this battle against terrorism?
Well, thank you so much for asking that, Lee. The Cuban Five are five Cuban men who were unjustly imprisoned here in the United States. they were tried and convicted in Miami in a perfect storm of prejudice. They came here to monitor paramilitaries that were planning and carrying out bombing attacks on hotels and other civilian sites in Cuba, right from Miami and South Florida. They, you know, especially since your program is called Africa on the Move, it's important to note that three of these five brothers also served in Angola, helping the MPLA and the people's struggle in Angola against apartheid during the 1970s and 1980s. They have been in prison now for 14 years and are also denied family visits in some cases. Two of the brothers are not even allowed to see their wives because the U.S. denies any visas for them to enter the U.S. and go to the prison.
Okay, in terms of the treatment of them, can you speak a little bit more about the treatment in prison that they've been receiving or not receiving? I recognize one of the human rights that all nations should recognize, the right to see your family. And I understand these brothers and sisters have not been able to see their wives and daughters and husbands. Can you just speak a little bit about that? Sister Cheryl?
Yes. In two cases, Gerardo Hernandez, who has a double life sentence plus 15 years, where the only crime he could have possibly be honestly convicted of is being an unregistered foreign agent, two life terms plus 15 years, his wife, Adriana Perez, is not, the U.S. has denied visas for her to come into the U.S. To see him. He hasn't seen her in 14 years. And then Renee Gonzalez, who actually was released from prison last October after serving his sentence, has now been, in addition, is sentenced to spend three more years in South Florida where his life is in danger. After he was released, they said he had to be on parole, and they refused to send him, the U.S. government refuses to send him back to his family in Cuba. And his spouse as well, Olga Salanueva, she is not allowed to come into the U.S. to visit him. And in fact, they tried to use the separation or the threat of separation when he was first arrested to get him to renounce his country and the struggle he was here to defend the people of Cuba and the Cuban Revolution.
Okay, Sister
other
Cheryl,
family members.
Sister Cheryl, we're running short. I'm going to stop you right quick.
Sure,
I got
sure.
30 seconds. I'd like for Brother Hakeem 30 seconds. If you could talk to the African community, why they should support the Freedom Five in 30 seconds, please. And then we've got to wrap it up.
Oh, real simply, the struggle of the brothers and sisters in Cuba is the struggle of people throughout the world. It's a struggle against injustice, oppression. It's a struggle against insanity. So people have a moral obligation, if not a political obligation, to struggle against this crazy country and to support the Cuban Five.
Okay, in closing, we'd like to thank our guests, Brother Hakeem from the African Women Association and Sister Cheryl from the U.S. Cuba Labor Exchange, for coming on tonight on Africa Don't Move and sharing their perspective on the world, their perspective dealing with things, speaking truth to power. We'd like to invite our audience back tomorrow night, same time, same station, at 11:30, where we can talk about more issues as relates to African people and humanity. Next time, like we said, we're going to claim no easy victory and tell no lies. We see you tomorrow at 11:30. Thank you for watching Africa Move. As your host, Brother African on the Move, we'll see you. Let's go forward and backwards now.